Genealogy by Tim, Season 2, Episode 8, recorded August 28th, 2022. It's been a very busy summer, genealogy-wise, but that doesn't mean I completed my summer challenges, unfortunately. I've got a lot of old business to follow up on today, and a little bit of new business to introduce. It's the end of the summer episode. It's going to bounce around a lot, and you're along with me for the ride today on Genealogy by Tim. Let's go over some old business. In last month's episode, I described a project in which I began preparing media galleries in Gramps, my local genealogy software, so that when I exported the family history from my software to my website, the gallery items would appear optimally on the website. This turned out to be a major undertaking. As of last month's episode, I've gotten through surnames beginning with the first two letters of the alphabet. This month, I'm pleased to report that I've still gotten through only surnames beginning with the first two letters of the alphabet. I took a pause to research two woefully under-researched family lines that I've rediscovered along the way, the Bolins and the Berries. Details on my progress on those lines will come up after old business. Another matter of old business is a side project that I adopted at Philadelphia National Cemetery, which is at Haines Street and Limekiln Pike in the Oak Lane section of Philadelphia. I set out to fully represent the soldiers buried at the cemetery's Mexican War monument on Find a Grave. The story behind the monument is that it was erected in the 1850s in the old Glenwood Cemetery, which was formerly located on Ridge Avenue near 27th and Burke Street in North Philadelphia. In the 1880s, military burials from around the city were consolidated at what is now the Philadelphia National Cemetery at Haines Street and Limekiln Pike. As time went by, the old Glenwood Cemetery fell into disrepair, and by the late 1930s, most of the remains were removed to what is now Glenwood Memorial Gardens in Broomall, and the cemetery was then closed. In the midst of all this moving, it has become unclear to me who exactly is currently buried at the Mexican War Monument at Philadelphia National. Many names are inscribed on the monument, but at the same time, the online gravesite registry findagrave.com often receives requests to find a soldier's name on the monument, and that name turns out not to be on there. Also at the same time, the Veterans Administration maintains a website called the Nationwide Gravesite Locator, or NGL, which seems to be the best available online authority on which soldiers are buried at which national cemeteries. And many soldiers identified on the site as being buried at the Mexican War Monument did not have memorials on Find a Grave. So I set out to correct the situation by creating Find a Grave memorials for all Mexican War Monument soldiers identified on the Nationwide Gravesite Locator. They are each identified by the site number, quote-unquote, and that helps me ensure that all soldiers are accounted for. As of last month's podcast, I had created 6 Find a Grave memorials for Mexican War Monument soldiers. But over the past few weeks, another Find a Grave user named Desert Thorn has reviewed my work and discovered some of the memorials that I created were duplicates. The soldiers were actually buried in other cemeteries and proven so by photographs of their current gravestones. Two such examples of these soldiers are John Ballier, who died in 1893, and John Bryant, who died in 1908. Both of these men are actually buried in other cemeteries, despite the Nationwide Gravesite Locator's report that they are buried by the Mexican War Monument at Philadelphia National. Ballier is claimed to be buried at Site 11, and Bryant is claimed to be buried at Site 21. It seems as though the VA's Nationwide Gravesite Locator, which I once took to be the gold standard of accuracy, is now showing some limitations. I'll have to take greater care in the future as I add memorials from the locator to find a grave. I will likely need to prepare a separate spreadsheet to keep track of them all. One last bit of old business kind of segues into the new business. On last month's podcast, I mentioned the prospect of visiting Philadelphia's Woodland Cemetery, also known as the Woodlands, in search of the infant Joseph Berry, who was born in 1869 and died in 1871. I also mentioned taking the cemetery's infant burials tour to honor young Joseph and others like him. I did stop into the cemetery one day this month, but apparently too late to catch anyone at the office. More details to follow in the next segment. And that brings us to new business. And the first piece of new business of the month is another family outing with my brother Kevin and his two children at a cemetery near his home in Delaware County. You may recall last year that I visited Glenwood Cemetery in Broomall with this same crew in search of John Quinlan, one of the Smiths who died in 2010. And we were able to find him at the mausoleum in the Glenwood Cemetery. Glenwood Memorial Gardens, that is, which replaced the original Glenwood Cemetery in North Philadelphia. The cemetery in question this summer was Mount Sharon Cemetery in Springfield, Pennsylvania. And the burials sought at this cemetery were those of Ava Cohen Snyder, who was the maternal grandmother of my maternal grandfather, Morris Anflick, and that of Herman Snyder, who was one of my grandfather's uncles, a son of Ava. I knew that Mount Sharon's cemetery office had been closed to visitors since the COVID outbreak, so I phoned ahead of time to get the locations of the burials. When my brother, his kids, and I got to the cemetery, we were unsure of how to find the graves in the allotted time. The sections of the cemetery were marked, but they were each quite large, and it wasn't clear to us exactly how the graves were arranged within each section. Now, if I were there by myself, I would have walked the entire section to find the grave, but Kevin didn't have that much time. He had to get home to hop on a Zoom meeting. We had to get the answers quickly. We took a two-pronged approach to get the help we needed. I called the office's telephone number and left a message. Kevin drove around the cemetery looking for a groundskeeper, and we found one. A bearded gentleman was able to guide us toward the general area where the grave was to be found. Once we were there, a cemetery representative responded to my call, and he was able to meet us at the site and confirm the gravesite location. This is something to keep in mind. If you get to a cemetery and the office happens to be close to visitors, there may still be folks on site who can at least point you in the right direction. There were a couple of things interesting about Ava's gravestone. First, the name engraved on it was Ava Snyder, even though the name on both her death certificate and apparently on cemetery records was Ava Music. Ava, in June of 1924, then in her 50s, married a gentleman by the name of Aaron Musicant, and she died just 4 months later. Either Ava or her survivors decided to use her first married name of Snyder on her gravestone. Secondly, Ava's death certificate identifies both her date of death and date of burial as November 16th, 1924, as if she were buried on the same day that she died. Mount Sharon Cemetery records corroborate this burial date, but Ava's gravestone monument identifies her death date as October 16th of that year. I cannot explain the discrepancy. There's about a two-week difference between the date of death and the date of burial, and that's fairly large from what I've experienced, especially of the Jewish community, in my research. The monument appears to be original from the period. It doesn't look like an error has been made many years down the line, creating a new monument for Ava, so I can't really say what's going on there. After locating Ava's monument in the cemetery, our focus shifted to Herman Snyder, who was a son of Ava's and one of my grandfather's uncles. The thing with him is that I'm not 100% sure I've got the right grave. The one thing that makes me believe it is him is that his 1948 death certificate identified his mother as Chova, C-H-O-V-A, which is similar to the Jewish equivalent of Ava. Ava's 1922 passenger list identified her as Chava, C-H-A-V-A. That's the closest I've been able to come to a definitive family connection. Herman is an important figure in the family because, according to Lipschitz bank records, he was responsible for arranging the passage of his mother, Ava, his sister Lillian, and brother Modal to America, so I'd like to get his story straight. Now, the Herman Snyder, whom I believe is Ava's son and my grandfather's uncle, seems to have died in 1948, and his death garnered a cryptic headline in the Philadelphia Inquirer of September 19th of that year. The headline was, "Retired Man, 53, Dies in Mystery." The article read as follows. "A 53-year-old retired laundry worker died of mysterious causes yesterday, 2 days after he was found unconscious in his apartment on 18th Street near Arch. Detectives and the coroner's office started an immediate investigation of the death of Herman Snyder of 112 North 18th Street. He died at Hahnemann Hospital. Snyder was found in a coma in his room early Thursday after a maid became alarmed when she was unable to gain entrance to his apartment. She called authorities who broke into the place. They found Snyder on a bed, it was reported. The room was not disturbed, but the man had several bruises on his head and right leg. At the hospital, attachés said that the victim died without regaining consciousness. Cause of death was listed there as a mystery. The coroner's office said a preliminary investigation showed that Snyder had lived at the 18th Street address for the past 6 years. He formerly was employed by a coat and apron supply firm." And the article ended there without identifying relatives. And to my knowledge, there was no death notice published. Herman's death certificate included the conclusion of the coroner's investigation. His cause of death was listed as lobar pneumonia due to anoxemia, acute heart failure. He apparently had a lung illness that caused low oxygen levels in his blood, but I don't know any additional details. Herman's gravestone was a bit easier to find than Ava's by stroke of luck, and my brother was able to get a photo of it surrounded by myself, my niece, and my nephew before he had to go hop on his Zoom meeting for work. So we were able to share a great afternoon together, reconnecting with old relatives. Now, after our visit to Mount Sharon, I had originally planned not to visit additional cemeteries in order to save some family adventures for later, but I simply could not resist. The cemeteries were too close to pass up a visit, and I was able to take photographs of the gravestone monuments of Ava Snyder's husband, Aaron Musicant, among other persons of interest, at Lebanon Cemetery later in the afternoon. After all of this photography, I then made my way to Woodland Cemetery to see if I could find the grave of baby Joseph Berry, whom I mentioned earlier. But I was not able to reach anyone inside the office, which I believe to be located in the cemetery's historic mansion. I assumed they'd all gone for the afternoon, and I was getting a little hot and tired and hungry from all of the grave finding of the day. So I called it a day at that time, and I didn't pursue young Joseph further. Locating his grave and taking the Woodland Cemetery's infant burials tour will occur at a later date. New business business item number two. Family Tree DNA has returned the results of its analysis of my DNA sample. My predicted haplogroup for Y DNA is JM267, otherwise known as haplogroup J1. Now, I can't pretend to be an expert on what this means, but my uncle, that is my mother's brother, was very excited about this result. When he tested his Y DNA with Family Tree DNA, he earned the site's Cohen Model badge for his DNA. The Cohen Model haplotype is a subset of the J1 haplogroup, and those who have this haplotype in their DNA come from a rare and important class of people in the Jewish heritage. My DNA has not yet been tested with enough specificity to earn the Cohen Model badge, but having a predicted J1 haplogroup puts me in the same neighborhood on my father's side as well as my mother's. Again, this is all very new to me. I'm trying to wrap my head around it all. What I know for sure from migration maps provided by Family Tree DNA is that my ancient ancestors, beginning with YDNA Adam in what is now Kenya, migrated through Ethiopia, northbound, then across the Red Sea to what is now Saudi Arabia, then west to what is now Israel. And from Israel, the J haplogroup split into JM267, also known as J1, and JM172, also known as J2. The J1 haplogroup migrated across northern Africa, westbound, and J2 migrated westbound across Europe on the other side of the Mediterranean Sea. And the J1s apparently crossed from Africa to Europe over the Strait of Gibraltar and continued from there eventually to the British Isles, where the surname Graham was established around the 1100s. In the process of discovering all this, I received emails from two fellow website users who are apparently relatively closely related to me, although I was not able to document a precise relationship with either of them. We certainly share a common ancestor, but this ancestor lived prior to my earliest known paternal ancestor, who, as of this recording, is a John Graham, who was born in about 1797 and died in County Antrim in what is now Northern Ireland in 1879. So these folks who emailed me, my common ancestor with them is earlier than 1797. One of those who emailed me, who asked to remain nameless, considered my genealogy origin story, as told by my grandfather in Season 1, Episode 7 of the podcast. This is a story in which some rabble-rousing Grahams tied an abusive clan chief to a dock at low tide so that he would die slowly as the tide rose in. And the emailer suggested that this might have been a reference to the assassination of King James I of Scotland in 1437. According to Wikipedia, King James I was chased into a sewer tunnel from which he could not escape. Sir Robert Graham was apparently involved in all of this, which led to a lot of persecution of Grahams, many of whom either fled Scotland or were driven out. I'm not sure if this is actually the event upon which my grandfather's story was based, but it is a very interesting lead, and many thanks go out to the one who reached out to me with this connection. One last item of new business this month is the resolution of a family history mystery that has persisted since the dawn of my genealogy research, and that is why my grandfather's grandmother, Katie Anflick, was identified in the 1920 census as Kate Shapiro while living with her daughter and son-in-law, Mary and Harry Cerruti. Marriage records in Richmond, Virginia, available on Ancestry.com, have revealed that Katie was married to an Aaron C. Shapiro in 1906. Sometime prior to 1910, Katie moved from Richmond to Philadelphia with her children. She denied her marriage to Aaron Shapiro in the 1910 census and identified herself as Katie Anflick, which was her prior married name. In 1920, the Sororities identified Katie by her legal married name, Kate Shapiro. But Aaron, who had been living in Richmond all this time, filed for and was granted a divorce in 1921 on the grounds of desertion. It isn't really clear what went on between the two, Katie and Aaron, to cause the separation. It has been suggested that this may have been a marriage of convenience, perhaps for citizenship or some other purpose, but this has not and probably won't be confirmed. Court records, if they exist, may shed more light, but they are not as readily available. Summer is just about over. I was actually back in the school building where I work, trying to get things ready for the students who arrive on Monday, August 29th. Let's check in on some of those summer challenges that I proposed to myself just 2 short months ago. Number one, the trip to Boston. Not going to happen, at least not this summer. I wasn't able to plan any trips. I had a few things preventing me from getting any trips in. For one, I had a week-long professional development session right in the middle of the summer, and that was prime time for road trip right there. In addition to that, I had some other appointments like driving tests and driving lessons, believe it or not. And these chipped away enough time here and there, so I couldn't really get a trip in. This one's going to have to wait. Challenge number two, have my DNA tested. Check. This one's done. I've been tested and the results have been returned, and now I'm in the phase of deciding on next steps. I'd better decide quickly, though. Family Tree DNA is having a summer sale that lasts through the end of August, which, of course, is fast approaching. Challenge number three, do some Jersey Shore genealogy. This one was actually accomplished, sort of. I did make it out to both the Atlantic City Department of Vital Records and to the Seaside Cemetery in Marmora. The cemetery was a complete success. I called the office ahead of time to get the location, and the woman there was very helpful and even had an orange flag placed at the gravesite to make it easier to find after office hours. The grave I found there was for William Franklin and Marie Schmidt-Hugendobler, both of whom died in the 1990s. William was a descendant of the Hugendoblers of Lancaster County, PA, whom I like to go out and research at least once a year. Didn't quite get out this year, though. Not yet, anyway. I was not as successful at the Atlantic City Department of Vital Records. I went there in search of a record of Lillian Snyder's third marriage, which was to a Harry Mitchell. Although the department's website claimed that it had marriage and death records beginning with the year 1921 through present, I was told at the office that I could not receive records for genealogical purposes there, and I was referred instead to the State of New Jersey Department of Health in Trenton. The rule there, however, is that marriage records must be at least 50 years old before they are released. Well, guess what? Lillian and Harry Mitchell were married in October of 1972, which will be 50 years ago in about 2 months. Well, that's fair enough. I just have to keep telling myself that a little bit more patience will soon be rewarded. Next up, number four, cold call some unexpected relatives. It still hasn't happened. That and challenge number five, take my nearest Lancaster relative out to lunch. Neither of these happen. These can be chalked up to not having a whole lot of free time this summer. And yes, on one hand, it doesn't take that much time to pick up a phone and make a call. On the other hand, I do like to spend time preparing for these calls so that I can answer some pretty detailed questions pretty quickly. And I do like to have some free time afterwards, after the call, to plan follow-ups, whether they be in-person meetings or lengthy email exchange. So time is an issue, but yeah, I don't know if that's really an excuse. Lastly, number 6, upload my photos of Kinderhook Cemetery to find a grave. I did begin this one. I did upload a few photos. If getting started is half the battle, then I'm claiming this one half done. I'll update you as I progress further on this challenge. So, out of 6 challenges, I claim completion of 2.5. It's a modest beginning for a new summer tradition. It certainly gives me plenty of room to improve next summer. And that's it. I've got a call today. Next month on the podcast, I'm considering devoting the full time slot to one of my family tree's more famous inhabitants, Joe Boland of Notre Dame fame. And I was able to do a little bit of research on him, read a little bit of his biography. You're not going to want to miss next month. Until then, keep on digging. Your next family history adventure awaits.